The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
The next blessing that we deal with in the order of the day is Al Netilat Yadayim. The Siddur starts off with Mode Ani Lefanecha, which establishes the fundamental goal of Judaism, which is a consciousness in direct relationship with God. What then happens in the order of the day after we say Mode Ani Lefanecha is traditionally next to our beds, is a cup of water. And we pick up this water and we pour it on our hands basically six times, which means once on the right, second on the left, third on the right, fourth on the left, fifth on the right, sixth on the left. And then we dry our hands. We then get up. After we've washed our hands immediately, we get dressed, we relieve ourselves in the bathroom, and then we come out again and we wash our hands again with a cup and say this blessing. Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, blessed are you, blessed be you, God, King of the Universe. Asher kidishanu mitzvotav, you have commanded us in your commandments, or you sanctified us in your commandments, v'tivanu al netilat yadayim, and you have commanded us on the washing of the hands. Okay? Yeah.
So when you're prepping up the washing of the hands and the following, you said that it's commanded.
Everybody. I'll talk about the various details in a second. I just want you to get the general scheme of things that Jews traditionally, and many Jews today, get up in the morning, after they say Mode Ani Lefanecha, they wash their hands with a cup, and then they go to the bathroom, wash their hands again with a cup, now they make a blessing, Al Netilat Yadayim. Now this blessing, Al Netilat Yadayim, is a blessing that we say whenever we have bread. In other words, according to Jewish law, prior to eating bread, we wash our hands with a cup, we make this very same blessing on the washing of the hands, and then we make a blessing over the eating of the bread. Okay. Now there are various reasons why we wash our hands in the morning. So before we deal with the meaning of the blessing itself, we want to deal with just the act itself. Why do Jews wash their hands in the morning? There are various reasons. Now, one reason, which is very obvious, right? Why do you wash your hands in the morning? Very good, right? To get them clean. That's brought down in the more mystical teachings in Judaism. But to get them clean. The other reason brought down is not only because of physical cleanliness, which is expressed in Jewish law as the hands are busy. When a person's sleeping, their hands are busy, which means their hands are touching various parts of their bodies, which is sweaty, and they wake up and they wash their hands. The interesting thing is that it does not say in Jewish law that your hands are dirty. It says that your hands were busy. Right? So we will have to deal with why was it expressed in that manner, hands being busy. The other idea brought down is because of spiritual uncleanliness. Not only a physical uncleanliness, but a spiritual uncleanliness. Why? Because when a person goes to sleep, what happens to them? They fall asleep. But what else happens to them? There's a partial disconnection between the soul and the body. Right? Partial disconnection between the soul and the body, and you go into a state of death. Well, not a complete state of death, but a partial state of death. And death for the Jewish people is impure, which we'll talk about the dynamics and the mechanics of that at the later half of this class. And therefore your hands are considered to be spiritually impure. There is this spirit of impurity that is on your fingers. Okay, and we'll talk about what that means a little later. Okay? And the third reason why would one wash their hands, what do you think? Is as an act of sanctification and dedication. Just as the Kohanim, the priests, when they would come into the temple, they would wash their hands. They would wash their hands as an act of sanctification, of lifting their hands up in the service of God. So too, we do. In other words, we have three basic reasons for the washing of the hands in the morning. Two which is based on the removal, right? Two which is based on the removal of something negative, whether it's something physically negative or spiritually negative. And the third is towards a positive, right? Towards a positive, as we develop towards a dedication towards God. Okay? Now we want to deal with the idea. First of all, in terms of dedication, the Jewish people have a consciousness that you are a priest. And that wherever you're going to be today is like a temple. And whatever you're going to do today can be a service. Right? Can be some type of service. There's this consciousness in Judaism that every day there is a new spark of divinity that can be raised out of each situation. In each situation, there's a new possibility to clarify divinity as it emerges into the world. Okay? And that really time, right, is a process of divine manifestation. That there really is time. Time isn't simply a description, but there's actually a very real process of time, right, which is an ongoing process of graduating manifestation of divinity in the world. Okay? And you and I are part of that, can be part of it. Every situation we're in offers us a new possibility for a new realization as to the meaning and the manifestation of divinity in the world. Okay? Each day for the Jewish people is the first day of the rest of their lives. It is crucial. It's not just like, oh, here's another day, but it's something very crucial in determining the rest of my life that could happen on this very, very day. Okay? And my hands, my deeds, my acts can be holy vessels and vehicles for the manifestation of divine truth in the world. Now that's all very nice, right? There's this act of sanctification, there's this act of dedication, right? But there's something very, very crucial that emerges through the halacha, through the Jewish law, as to how we Jews understand the meaning of sanctification. To wash your hands, in order to sanctify them, you must use a cup. And this cup must be a cup which is permanent. Preferably not a disposable cup, but a cup that has dignity. Right? A cup that has dignity. Now, if for some reason you can't find a cup that has some dignity to it, but you can only find a disposable cup, that would be better than nothing. Now, according to Jewish law, when you wash your hands as an act of purification and sanctification, it must be out of koach gavra. And koach gavra means human strength. In other words, you cannot just turn on the faucet and put your hands underneath the water. That would not effectualize sanctification for the Jewish people. It has to be you take this cup of water and you dump it on your hands. Right? And let's say you were in a restaurant and you could not find a cup. Right? So what would you do in order to wash your hands for bread? Right? So at the bare minimum, since you cannot find a cup, you would put your hands under the faucet and turn it off and on very quickly. So that at least there would be still that statement that the water is born out of your strength. Right? Not simply this running water, you passively put your hands underneath it and it purifies you, but that you are responsible, that you have somehow initiated the process, that you turned it on. Right? At the bare minimal of halakha, if you could not find a cup. But the ideal is that you have a cup, and you take this cup, and you pour it on your hand. And the question is, why? I mean, why is this so important? What's the difference, right? What's the difference? Now, what's suggested over here is something very crucial in understanding the meaning of Jewish purification and sanctification. Right? Because the truth is, the bracha that we make on the washing of the hands is al netilat yadayim. And netilat yadayim means what? Well, generally it's translated in many sidurim as the washing of the hands, but it doesn't mean washing. What's the word in Hebrew for washing? Richitza. Lerchatz is to wash. Netila means to lift up, and netila also means to take. What I'm actually doing is I'm lifting up my hands and I'm taking my hands. I'm not simply washing my hands. I am lifting up my hands. Al netilat yadayim means to lift up the hands. Al netilat yadayim means to take the hands. Now what does this mean? And why does it have to be through the power of this cup? Now there's a basic understanding amongst people in the world as to the nature of religiosity. That generally people assume that any person who is inclined to be religious must in some way be some kind of nebuch, right? Some kind of schmo, you know, some miskin, some unfortunate neb who couldn't make it in their life, right? They couldn't make it in their life, right? They didn't succeed in the real world. You know, in the real world, what's tough, where you got to make choices and where you've got to decide and determine. You know, you're sitting there in the real world in your office in Manhattan making real decisions about real situations, right? There, that's tough. That's people in the world, right? But, you know, people who, like, want to escape, those are religious people. You know, they like to go on mountains, meditate, you know, believe that everything will be all right. God will save you. God will protect you. All you got to do is believe. Right, and obviously, right, that kind of attitude is like, there's something wrong with you. I remember a friend of mine, a student of mine, took me to this, it was a cocktail party of his parents' friends. And he's now become a little more, you know, observant in his Jewish identity, and he said he wanted me to come with him, right? So I came with them, and there were all these people at the cocktail party, you know, at the King David, and they hadn't seen this fellow in a long time. So one very close friend of his mother comes up and says, "Oh, Stephen, I'm so happy you finally found yourself. I mean, you've been searching for so long. I mean, I'm just so happy that at least, you know, you're happy. I mean, that's, you know, the important thing is, you know, you're just happy." Right? With this condescending sense that you never, right? You never made it, Stephen. Right? You can never go, you know, your brother was in college. You know, your brother's a lawyer, your sister's a doctor, and you never made it, so at least you're happy. You know, at least you're happy. And you should understand that it really takes on a very sophisticated philosophical approach, too. Right? Because Nietzsche believed that there were two types of people in the world. There were strong ones, and then there were weak ones. Right? The strong ones, they do what they want to do. The strong ones, they know, life is in my hands, I'm strong. But the weak ones, they're weak. But he believed that the weak ones, although they were weak, they were smart. And they came up with morality and ethics, right? That was their plan, their plot, to make the strong ones feel guilty that they're so strong, right? And he believed that the weak ones was basically the Jews, right? And that the Christians continued the plot that the Jews have brought upon the world to make healthy, happy, strong people feel guilty in their strength and submit themselves and realize their nothingness in the face of God who will save. Right? And of course everyone knows the famous statement of Karl Marx, which is that basically religion is the opiate of the masses, right? And that anybody who's religious must be on a flight of escape from the real issues that one must deal with in the world. Now, I don't know about other religions. Actually, I kind of do know about other religions. But I certainly can tell you about Judaism, that that's not Jewish. In fact, there's a verse in the Tanakh that says, what does God want from you? Ha'osin devaro bigvuro. God wants man to do his will out of strength, out of assertiveness, not out of weakness. That the process of purification for the Jewish people must be out of koach gavra, human strength, right? Not a passivity as the waters from above come pouring down upon you as you put your hands under the faucet. But even the smaller acts of our daily life represents the ideals that we want to maintain foremost on our minds and consciousness. That purification and dedication must be out of strength. You see, nowadays, people who ask questions are considered to be weak. But for the Jewish people, we always believe, that only the person who's got the guts to ask a question, to admit they're confused, right, only such a person, right, is going to find truth in their lives. Nowadays, people who are confused are seen as if they're weak, they're nebs, they can't make it, right? But we believe that the real nebs are the ones who don't have the guts to admit they are confused. They don't have the guts to admit that they really don't have their life together. Right? And there's really actually so much, right, that must be explored with strength, right, with courage, to step into the unknown, ask the questions, and rock the boat of the security that maybe I have to make a change in my life. Maybe this is not really the best way of living, right? So I find very often those people who are generally categorized as confused really have an inner strength, very often, a strength which is not appreciated in today's society, right, which is unfortunate. But for the Jewish people, we do not believe that one can approach God out of weakness. One must approach God out of strength. And only then can there be a relationship between man and God. When the human being has confidence in themselves that what they're doing and what they can do is very, very powerful. Right? Very, very powerful. So rather than the notion that religion is giving up my sense of self, right? Al-Mtilat Yadayim means I raise my hands, I actually take my hands. I take my life into my control and I make decisions and I determine where am I going to go with the confidence, and this is the amazing thing, the confidence that what I will do today has cosmic significance. I mean, that takes a lot of personal strength to believe that. That what I've got to do today has cosmic significance. And that's Judaism. I mean, it really is, apparently, from first glance, ridiculous that a Jew Friday night takes two candles, two insignificant candles, takes a match, lights this match and makes a bracha. Can you imagine how ridiculous a bracha? Blessed be you, King of the universe, who has commanded me, right, to light these candles. They're ridiculous. Are you nuts? You think there's significance to you lighting a candle? You think there's any meaning and relevance to you taking a senseless match and lighting two little candles and putting it on your table and somehow you get some kind of, you know, cosmic, right, relevance attributed to that act? You're crazy. Well, I might be crazy, but on the other hand, that is a testimony that I believe that I do things. And when I do something, it really could mean something. That there is divine concern to what I do, because what I do has divine significance. Right? That's amazing. That takes courage. Right? To be Jewish means to be very courageous and believing that little acts, which of course should only teach you that, of course, big acts have significance. Rav Kook once said, that you know what is a great person? Great people seek to do small things in great ways. That's a great person. You know, certain people feel it's below my dignity, right, to do that. You know, we can let the house servants take care of that. It's below my dignity. Right? Below my dignity. But we believe a truly great person is a person who sees greatness in everything. And that even little thing. Right? Because when you think of it on a grander scale, the big things are insignificant too, if you're going to be scientific about it. Right? Pardon? Right. I mean, even the great things, you know. You think you're the president, right? Jimmy Carter, who are him? I mean, you know, he's gone. You know, he's raising, I don't know what he does on his ranch, whatever, what?
Peanuts,
right? And maybe someday he'll build a peanut factory and we'll be starting to use, you know, Carter peanut butter. You know, and he'll make it into public awareness once again. But in the meantime, from peanuts you came, from peanuts you returned. I mean, you know. But at the time you say, oh, look how significant I am, the President of the United States. Right? Even the big things, right, are insignificant. Right? In the eyes of mankind, anything you do is ultimately insignificant, given enough time. But in the eyes of God, anything you do at any time, big or small or big, is significant. That's what Jews believe. Right? We believe that we are filled with a spirit that enables us to do apparently insignificant acts. And we believe in ourselves so much that I did something. And I can do something. That, remember, is what we find in Abraham. That's the first encounter with a Jew. He did something. He wasn't sitting, meditating, contemplating. You see, for certain religion, the highest level is contemplation. Right? For Jews, the highest level is to do something, right? Not contemplation. Right? And study is only meaningful if it brings you to do something. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. Right? So for the Jewish people, Al Netilat Yadayim is crucial because it's based on an understanding that I can raise my hands, that these human hands can actually transcend to become a vehicle for the expression of cosmic will as it permeates reality in my everyday mundane world. Unbelievable. And on top of that, it's not only raising my hands, right? But I'm taking my hands. I'm taking my life, determining my direction and saying, hey, I can do something. I can really do something. But then let's go to the next level, which is, so what is this practice of purification anyway? Okay, Judaism says it's got to be strength, right? And that God wants man to do his will out of strength, not out of weakness. And that the goal of the Jew is to do it as a statement of assertiveness in the context of a relationship with God, which takes incredible personal self-esteem and confidence that yes, indeed, you can do that. Right? Available to you, as insignificant as you scientifically might be. Right? But inside there's a great spirit of strength that says, I can do something. That is true gvura. Okay, true gvura, true strength. But what then is the mechanics of the process of purification? Now there is a basic idea in Judaism that King Solomon established the washing of the hands. Interesting idea. Only when King Solomon came on the scene, the stage of Jewish history, was he the first person to institute halachically, according to Jewish law, the washing of the hands and something called an eruv. Now an eruv is this interesting idea that relates to Shabbat. On Shabbat, we are not allowed to carry from a private domain to a public domain. Right? And another time we'll talk about why that's so. But anyways, King Solomon came up with an idea called an eruv, which was this legalistic kunz, right? This legalistic way, loophole, of creating everything into a private domain by running a wall around the city. Right? And nowadays, in Jerusalem, for instance, although we are not allowed in Shabbat to carry from a private domain to a public domain, so I could not take my sitter outside of this apartment, right? We can today, because the rabbinate has put around Jerusalem a line There is a line, a metal line, that goes all the way around Jerusalem. And you can see it if you go to some of the outskirts, right? If you go to the promenade over at Talpiot, if you look down, you'll actually see this line. The way you can see it is they tie to it red ribbons, right? So they can see if it fell down. And there's actually someone who patrols every Friday morning the entire Eruv to make sure that's not down, right? Because then people wouldn't be able to carry it. Certain communities in the States have around the community this Eruv, right? The community I lived in Queens, they actually have a light system that will go red electronically if the Eruv falls down, so people would know not to carry that week. Right? Interesting idea. Anyway, King Solomon came up with this idea. Right? And when he came up with this idea, this voice, this divine voice came out of the sky, so the Talmud describes, right? And says, Shlomo, you're such a chacham. Right? Why? So wisdom. Now the question is, what's the chachma over here? What is the connection between washing your hands and making an eruv? Right? It seems to be completely different. Well, first of all, we have to appreciate what is the root of evil according to Judaism. Now, of course, everything will unfold from this root. Right? And this various approach is philosophically, what is evil? Right? What is evil? Well, this is the Jewish approach, and I tell you the truth, the other approaches that I've seen amongst the various philosophers in terms of evil unfold from this original idea, I believe. The root of evil for the Jewish people, right, is fragmentation. And the root of goodness is harmony and unity. The root of evil is disintegration. And the root of goodness is integration. Integration. In the family of evil, or a number of children, right, within the category of evil, there is impurity. Right? The offspring of evil. Right? There is the category of profane. There's the category of depression. These are all various manifestations of the original root, which is actually evil. Actually evil. But in the family of good, various members of the family, there is purity, there is sanctity, there is holiness, and there is happiness. Happiness. Now how does it work? How does it work? When a person goes to sleep, they're considered to be 1/60th dead. Why? Because you've just entered into a state of fragmentation. Sleep is a fragmentation. Why? Because number one, my soul is partially disconnected from my body. They're not completely working together. And my mind is not completely unified with my actions. I'm doing things. I mean, ever see somebody sleepwalk? It blows you away. I mean, they're walking. They can even be talking. And yet they're sleeping. It's really haunting, you know? I mean, it's very frightening to see someone sleepwalking. Because you can see that person could do something and yet not know they're doing it whatsoever. Right? The truth is, a lot of people are still sleepwalking, you know? Because they're doing and they have no understanding of what they're doing. Right? Ultimately, they never woke up. They look like they wake up in the morning, get out of bed, you know, brush their teeth, you know, they have cereal, you know, but none of this helps them because they're still sleeping. Right? Because there is no integration in what they're doing. There is actually no understanding. They're doing one thing, they're thinking another thing, they're feeling another thing, and their soul is off, you know, in Bermuda. I don't know where. But there is no connection. They're completely disconnected from themselves, from the world. Right? They're aliens to themselves. A lot of people. Huh? Now, Judaism is a process of integration. That's really what it is. It's a process of integration. A process of unification. My concern is that my actions are coordinated and integrated with my values. My heartfelt values. But then my actions and my heartfelt values and my emotions are integrated with my ideals. My philosophical visions. And that my actions, my values, my ideals are unified with my will. And that my actions, my values, my ideals, and my will are unified with my being, which would be unified with the being of my community, which would be unified with the being of the universe, which would be unified with the source of all being, God. Now, we could do that. There would be so much life force flowing through you. Every step you would take, you would be carried by wind. It's a very high level. And this is what it means to be happy. Happiness is a function of things fit in my life. And I fit. Meaning, what's the meaning of meaning? It's when I fit. I fit together and I fit into the world and the world fits into a universal reality beyond all, which we call Hashem. And when I write a list of everything I did in the last week, and then I write another list of everything I want to do in my life, a list of my values, my aspirations, to the extent that these two lists are unified, is to the extent that I am happy. And I'll feel it. To the extent that these two lists are unified, to that extent I will feel the force of life permeating my being. But to the extent that they just have nothing to do with each other, which is very often, unfortunately, the case. You can talk to people, you can sit down and talk to people about philosophy, you know, ideals, you know, what do you think life is, you know, one of those conversations that drunks have, you know, for a bar, you know, what life is all about, you know, and there's all these really incredible, I mean, you could write books and books and books of the most beautiful, depth, deep, philosophical appreciations of life. But when my philosophy and my actions have very little to do with each other, right, then I'm a fragmented being, right? That is actually the strength of Judaism, right? Because Judaism has incredible philosophy, but you can find a lot of these philosophies in various teachings. Right? But you know what it says? It says that we heard the Torah from the mouth of the strong one, Mipi HaGvura. And the element of Gvura in Judaism is the ability to concentrate lofty ideals into mundane actions. That's real strength. If you can take all that light of life and put it into washing dishes, cleaning the house, smiling at your friend, that is really the strength of Judaism. The ability to translate the transcendental, lofty visions into very real, practical actions in the very everyday mundane. That's real strength. That's something people don't have. You know, there's those who are the visionaries, and then there are those who are practical. The practical have very little light and very little vision very often. And then the theoretical, the visionaries, they can hardly bring it into the practical. Right? That's always the problem. The visionaries have so much light, but they cannot translate it into practical terminology. And then there's those people who are very, very practical, but they have very little light that fills the practicalities, and they're very boring people very often. The goal is to find the visionary and the practical, and being able to unify, translate, and convert, right, infinite light into moments of eternity. But moments of eternity. Being able to translate endless space into places, right, of infinity, but places. That's the strength of Judaism. You know, a lot of people came out of the drug culture looking for a religion. Why? Right? A lot of these people. Because to get high isn't so hard. You know, not so hard. But after you've tasted the high, how do you live with it in the everyday? How do you translate what you knew at that moment of encounter with whatever that was that you encountered, right, in that lofty state, right, beyond the world? How do you translate it to the everyday actions? That's the success of Judaism. Right? To translate it into what would generally be called mundane, insignificant acts, into acts that are filled with the divine will. So that's real happiness. When I can bring the two worlds together, when I can bring all my universal visions into very practical, particularized forms, right, in the here and now world. So that's real happiness, and that's what Judaism strives for and successfully does. it unifies two apparently completely different worlds. Right? As it brings the spiritual and the physical into a unity, right? A complementary relationship, which brings about the manifestation of God. But the problem is people don't have that, right? How do I unify myself, within my community? How do I succeed in bringing myself into coordination with the true rhythm of life? That's the goal of Judaism. And so when I am disintegrated, I am basically sick, either physically sick or spiritually sick. I am dis-ease, literally. Right? There is dis-ease in my life because things are not flowing. There is no harmony in my being, right? And the relationship between my being and the source of being. That is the goal of Judaism. Now, that's what impurity is. Impurity is a spirit of fragmentation in the world. Evil is based on the illusion that everything is broken into pieces. In fact, the word evil in Hebrew, ra, is connected to another word in Hebrew which is spelled the same but with an extra ayin at the end, which means to break into pieces. Right? Evil seeks to break things into pieces, and goodness seeks to bring it all together. Evil seeks to convince you that you are self-defined, disconnected, isolated, and really actually fragmented and cut off from the rest of reality. But goodness seeks to expose the interrelatedness of everything. Goodness seeks to expose that we're all interfaced, and that within the particular is the universal, and within the universal is the particular. One yet not one the same. That's the goal and the strength of goodness for the Jewish people. So here I am sleeping, and I am fragmented because my body is not working with my soul. Right? My soul is off in some trip, enjoying perhaps visions, which you could only enjoy while I'm in a sleep state, but still my being is fragmented. And on the other hand, my hands are busy. They're not just dirty. Why does the halakha refer to it as busy? Because they're busy, right? They don't know, they're busy, they're not doing anything. But they're busy. You see a lot of people, they're busy. You see busy people, right? And you watch them after a while, you say, wow, look how much they're doing. You realize they're not doing anything. They're just busy, right? Trying to keep themselves convinced that they're actually doing something, but they're really doing nothing, right? It just looks that way. It's like when you watch ants, they're so busy, right? But after a while, you realize they're going in circles, and you get dizzy, right? They're busy, and they're dizzy, and you can't deal with it, right? They look, there they go. You know, they're building, you know, things, and they're lifting things that are 100 times their own weight. I don't know, you know, and they, wow, look at those ants, right? And they go up, and then they come down, and they go back up, and they go around, and they, you're like, wow. But you look at some people, and that's really their lives, right? People try to convince themselves that they're doing something by keeping themselves busy, right? But it's just an illusion, because they're not really doing anything. So the hands... Why are the hands the impure? Why don't I wake up in the morning and take a big bucket and drop it 6 times on my head? Right? I mean, you know, purify. Why not? Go for the whole thing. Right? Well, because the process of integration happens on its own. If I wake up, then my soul is anyways integrating into my body. But what is left for me to do? What do I have to do through my own choices in the process of life, which is integration, and death, which is disintegration? In order to come out of death and be alive, I must integrate my actions. And when we wash our hands, we say, Al Netilat Yadayim, the raising of my hands, I put my hands in front of my face. And you'll see that's what they do. They wash their hands, they put their hands in front of their face. Don't do it too long because the water will drip down your sleeve. But, you know, Al Netilat Yadayim, raise up your hands, put it in front of your face, and then you wipe your hands. Okay? You wipe your hands after you wash the hands, you make the blessing, then you wipe the hands. Because I want to integrate. Water in Judaism is always the symbol of the power of integration. The Torah is referred to as water. Why? Because water integrates. Water brings things together. Water has a certain cohesive nature. Right? Fire in Judaism, on the other hand, although can be used properly, when used properly, it can also purify. The fire for Judaism ultimately is a source of disintegration. When I take fire and I burn something, it disintegrates. Right? It's a little piece of cinder. But when I put water on something, it dissolves it and brings it into some kind of unity. Unity. So water in Judaism is always the power of purification. And we're not talking about symbolism over here. We're talking about a metaphysical religion that believes that this is actually doing something. I mean, you're actually doing something. There is a spirit of impurity, a spirit of disintegration. And I take waters of integration and I pour them on my hands. And it's my hands that are the most disintegrated part of my body. Because my hands can go in so many different directions, more than anything else in of my body. And then there's my fingers, which are even more vulnerable to disintegration. Right? And it's there that the spirit of disintegration rests, there upon which I take the waters of integration and I pour them on. As I take my hands, so the power of pouring this water on my hands, taking my hands, putting them in front of my face, and say, I want these hands to reflect me. I want these hands to reflect me. So that's the process of purification in Judaism. Now, why is this the next thing in the morning? In the morning we wake up, we say, Modani Lefanecha, thanking I am before you. Right? With consciousness and clarity in direct relation with God. Why? Because you gave me back my soul. The spark of divinity, which gives me consciousness and the possibility for a sense of self in direct relation with God. Why then is the next move the washing of the hands? Well, first of all, remember, Judaism believes in action. Meditation is important only as a preparation to action. We do not need Abraham sitting in a lotus position or in a Star of David position, right? We see Abraham moving, right? Get up and go. I once heard in the name of a guru, who said, if you come to me, it's in order to learn how to sit. But a rabbi would say, if you come to me, it's in order to learn how to walk. Right? How to walk. That's what we're interested in doing. We believe that Moda Ani Lifanecha, the encounter with God, the consciousness and the direct encounter with God, thanking and acknowledging, I am before you, in direct relation, the direct implications of that encounter will be action. Moral action, ethical action, actions of love and care and concern, sensitivity. That would be the result of Moda Ani Lefanecha. And that is the way to Moda Ani Lefanecha. It is not only the result, but it's actually the way. How does one encounter God? How does one really come to the acknowledgement and the full gratitude of themselves as an I in direct relation with God? It's through action, so the Jews believe, not contemplation. Right? It's not contemplation. Action is the way to God. It's moral, ethical living. The fulfillment of responsibility. If you want to encounter your beloved, it's not by sitting there meditating on each other. Right? It's action. It's fulfilling the responsibility that represents a relationship. And it doesn't matter, even if a person keeps looking you in the eye and say, oh, I love you, I love you, I love you. If they do not fulfill their responsibilities, which are incumbent upon lover to beloved, right? If they do not fulfill the responsibilities that manifest the relationship and ultimately really establish the relationship, then they don't really love you. Love is an action, really. Right? It's not just a feeling I get. It's an action I do. Right? And therefore, Al Mitzilat Yadayim is the next step in the morning. We first clarify our goal, Mode Ani Lefanecha, a gracious sense of I before thou. And we recognize the implications of such an encounter and the ultimate way to that encounter, which is action. You see, very often we go into some state of death, right? Because that's to a certain extent really what depression is. Now, of course, what do you do at that point? You know, you got to get out of your depression and you speak to your friend. Oh, I'm depressed. And your friend becomes very philosophical. Explain to you why you shouldn't be depressed. And why it's so irrational and ridiculous that you're depressed. Right. And it makes so much sense that you're even more depressed. Because now you realize that you don't even have the right to be depressed. I mean, at least before, you know. But now you explain to me and you clarify how I should be happy and I have no right to be depressed and there's no reason to be depressed. And now I'm really, really ready to jump out the window. Thank you for helping me. Right? What helps us get out of depression? It's doing something. Not talking. Talking will help you get out of depression only because you're talking. You can talk about baseball, you'll feel just as good, probably even better than talking about your problems. Because a clarity and a contemplation of your problem is not what helps. What helps change your inner life, your inner climate, is your actions. That's what changes life. You've got to get up and do something. The extent that what you're doing is meaningful, to that extent you'll feel even better. If it just means turning on the radio and dancing, you'll feel better. But you'd feel better if you went out and did something for someone else. Right? Because sometimes, very often, depression is I'm so locked up in myself that I've cut myself off from the rest of the world, which itself is what it means to be depressed. Right? Cut off from the world beyond myself. I'm locked into my personal existence. I'm trapped in myself. And in myself, that is where I feel very lonely and sad. But when I move out of myself, right, I discover an inner real me. Right? And it's from there I tap into the source of life once again. So you got to do something. More than the mind directs action, the Jews believe that action directs mind. Right? More than feelings direct action, the Jews believe actions direct feeling. Very, very important and very crucial. Because a lot of people say, so what do you need all these acts for? You know, at Sinai, the Jewish people said a very famous statement, right? Naseh v'nishma, we will do, and then we will hear it, right? Hear it. Nishma means to hear it. Like when someone says something to you, you say, yeah, I hear it. It's a deep comprehension. The Jewish people understood that Judaism is life, and life you can't think about. You're either embracing it, dancing with it, or you're out of it. Right? I can guarantee you, if you sit around and think about life, you'll realize it's ridiculous, meaningless, and stupid. Right? The more you think about it, the more meaninglessness you will feel. Because your mind cannot encounter reality. It can only sit back and look at it. You've got to get up and do. You've got to get involved. And Judaism, being not a philosophy, but a way of life, could be only understood if you are ready to experiment with the way of life. You can only really know what we're talking about, right? Through doing it, through experimenting with it. Because what Judaism has to say is in the language of action. Jews really, really strayed or basically stayed away from philosophy. Now, there's lots of philosophy in Judaism. But the truth is, they talk about the law most of the time. And you wonder why they talk about the law most of the time. And you know, you wonder, you go in yeshiva, they don't talk about God. They talk about the law. Why do they talk about the law so much, right? Because we talk about what you do. Because what you do is the language that expresses your philosophy, and what you do is the testimony of your encounter with God. And everything else is just words. We're not interested. We're interested in behaving in a way that represents what we believe in, and behaving in a way that testifies to our honest encounter with the source of reality of Supreme Being, God. Right? And that's all. A Jew that says, I believe in God, is meaningless to us. Right? Your behavior will tell us what you believe in. That's what interests us. Behavior. Life. Not thoughts about life. Life itself. And therefore, you know, it's like watching Hasidim dance. Have you ever watched the Hasidim dance? They dance. After a while, you get dizzy, right? Then what are they doing? They sing the same song over and over again, and they dance in this little circle, and they can do it for hours sometimes. Right? You say, what are these people doing? From outside, it looks like these people are going in circles. But if you're ready to get in and dance with them, right, you'll realize that they're going in spirals. And they never, never come to the same point twice. But that you can only know in action. Right? The only way you can know something is through action. It's through behavior. It's through life. Sitting back and thinking about the world is meaningless. But if you get up and you see a person walk down the street carrying some heavy parcels and you say, hey, let me help you, you will know that life is meaningful. You might not be able to philosophically understand how that's so, but what's the difference? It's so. You know it. You encountered it. You know that when there's someone on the street, down and out, and you reach into your pocket and you give them a shekel, you know that life is meaningful. You know that there's something that you can do that has significance. You feel it. You feel your being filled with a light that says, way to go! That's it. That's what it's all about. Right? You know when you love, you're part of reality. And you know when you hate, that somehow you're disconnected from the light, the source, the real energy. You know these things. Philosophically, it doesn't make any sense. But it doesn't have to make any sense. Right? All I want to do is make sense out of my sense that I get through my direct encounter as I reach out with my hands to touch the world rather than sit back and look at it. That the only way you can know truth is to get involved. And therefore, we believe that the encounter with God, the Moda Ani Lifanecha, that consciousness, that awakening, that acknowledgement, that gratitude, right, can only be through action. Right? Because life is a movement. Life is an action, not simply a thought or a passing thought. So that is crucial to Jewish living. To understand that. To get involved in it. Right? I could describe to you a cake over and over again, but you'll have to simply taste it. If you're not willing to taste it, you will never know what it is. And so too with Judaism. If you're coming to sit and listen to classes and write a bunch of notes, you will not know anything about Judaism, right? Nothing, right? Because all we're doing is pointing to the actions to help you appreciate a little bit of what the actions is in order to get involved. See, I remember I was once at the Kotel. It was actually one of my first times at the Kotel 15 years ago. And at the back area of the Kotel, you know, where the crowd is, there was this choir singing hymns to Jesus on a Friday night. It was a little inappropriate, you know, a little inappropriate. So I was overwhelmed, you know, I get to the Holy Land, and it was one of my first times at the Kotel, and what do I see? This big group of people singing hymns on Friday night. Anyway, so I figured maybe it's better I broach them first before someone might throw a rock or something. I mean, so I figured I'll go up to them and say, listen, you know, I think this is a little trophy. And a couple other people came and started talking to them and told them that they didn't think this was really right, you know. And there was this big, long conversation. And these two fellows pick on me, right? And they start talking to me, trying to tell me about Jesus. And they say to me, you know, but Jesus saves and Jesus loves you and all you have to do is believe. And they gave me the whole line. And so I said, listen, tell me, how do you know that Jesus is real? How do you know that Jesus is your Messiah? How do you know that Jesus is the Son of God? How do you know? So he said to me, I asked him. You know, that's rational. Yeah. Okay, fine. I said, you asked him. He said, yes. I said, how exactly did you do that? Right? So he said, I opened up my heart to Jesus. And I said, Jesus, are you real? Right? You see how that one works? Right? So he said, uh-huh, okay. So he said, and that's how you will know Jesus. Ask him, brother. Open your heart up right this moment, brother, and ask him. Say it, Jesus, are you real? Right? And I said, I can't do that. Right? He said, you've got to do that. That's the only way you can know. I said, if you give me sound reason why I should do that, I will do it. Right? Because I would never in a million years believe that I could know something without trying it experientially. Right? I mean, we're talking about life. We're not talking about ideas. Right? We're talking about life, and life you've got to encounter. You've got to feel. You've got to touch. You've got to get inside. Right? So I said, I'd be willing to do that. But you have to give me, right, something that will make that choice responsible. Right? Not just like, you know, I could open my heart up to anybody, right? But if you give me a reason, a foundation upon which I would then open my heart. Right? And I turned around and walked away. Well, and he grabbed me. Right? He grabbed me, literally grabbed me, turned me around, looked me in the face, and said, I love you! Right? I said, well, thanks. I mean, but you don't even know me, right? And I just walked away. Right? Because a religion, you know, it's not blind faith. Right? But faith means where the mind stops and says, I cannot go on. Where the rational mind knows its limitations and says, we've come to the border, and if you want to go on, right, you're going to have to explore with a whole new device, right, that goes beyond your mind. Right? Too many people are stuck. They can only go as far as what they see, right, as far as what they can understand. But life is so incomprehensible anyways that if you waste your time trying to make sense out of it, right, you'll never get there. You just want to make sense out of your sense of it as you encounter it with the fullness of your being. And that's the only way you can know a religion like Judaism, which isn't a religion, but a way of life. Right? An ongoing encounter with God. Actions which always represent, manifest, and even go beyond that, create the relationship with the source. So this is what Jews are all about. If you sit around and think about life, life is much, much too large to be stuffed into the narrowness of our minds. Right? In order to get there, we have to climb out of ourselves, out of the rigidity of the logistics that we've set up through which we want to view the world, and get out of it and touch it. Feel it, grab it. And that's the only way you could ever really know Judaism. The only way one could really say, I've honestly explored what it means to be a Jew, is to at least try and live like a Jew for a while. And then only then you could say, I understand its authenticity. Right? Only then could it be authentic, because if it's life, then the only way you could honestly say you explored it is if you explore it like you have to explore life, but you've got to get in there. Right? You can't be outside. You can't know something from outside when you talk about life. You can only know it from inside. And therefore, there are those who are outsiders, there are those who are insiders, there are people who have their PhDs in Talmud. They don't know anything about Talmud. Right? They only know about Talmud. But if you want to know Talmud, you've got to get inside. Right? So, nothing wrong with a PhD. Right? But there's only one way of knowing life. It's getting inside, not observing it and talking about it. Right? You've got to get inside it. I once heard a story about Bertrand Russell, and he was teaching a course in ethics. And one day in the middle of his class, they say this is a true story, some girl got up and said, how can you teach this stuff when you went to bed with me last night? So Bertrand Russell was a little overwhelmed by that. Right? But then another girl got up and said, I don't believe it. You said I was the only one. You went to bed with me the night before that. I can't believe it. Right? And then this other girl got up and said, what? This is ridiculous. Right? Well, there was a place went sky high, and of course the dean of the college called him in. He said, well, what's going on over here? What are these rumors I hear? Right? You're teaching a course in ethics. Right? What is going on? And he answered, do you expect your math teachers to be a triangle? Why would you expect an ethics teacher to be ethical? I teach the stuff. What's it got to do with what I do? As if there are two worlds, right? There's, you know, what you teach. Now, it has nothing to do with what I do. It has nothing to do with reality. We just sit here and we make money and we write books, right? As we maintain our distance from contact with the authentic reality that faces us each day, right? Like, that's the point. Ideas, philosophies, words, either they are windows or doors which you have to go through. They're only openings you've got to enter in, right? Or they're walls, right? That's all the philosophies are worth, as doors that we can open, and then we have to enter with the fullness of our beings to explore life. It's with everything that's part of life. Not just mind, and not without mind either. Not just heart, but not without heart either. We have to enter with the fullness of our beings. So just to quote a couple of non-Jewish philosophers, which seems to give Jews a feeling like, oh, okay. So this is from Kierkegaard. Applies condemnation to pure thinking as treason to the spirit. Right? That's what it is. Thinking, just thinking, is treason to your spirit. Right? It's a way of strangling yourself, right? To sit around and think too much. Right? Faith, in its positive sense, isn't blind. But faith means to get out of those limitations, right? And to entertain the possibility of knowing something in a more direct way that transcends just the neat package of the rational world, right? If you want to be rational about love, it's irrational. And if you want to philosophize about the importance of loving, right, then it's truly unimportant. The only way you could know love is if you get involved. And the only way you could know God or anybody, right, is if you get involved. There's a vast, vast difference between your world and your words and your thoughts and the reality that you could encounter. Now, I remember when I was going out on dates, so I thought it would be a very valuable thing to write a list of everything I'm looking for, right? Because I was so tired of going out on all these dates. I said, you know, what are you looking for, David? So I sat down, and I wrote a list. And I'm talking about a very serious list. I mean, I was a boom, boom, boom. Everything I'm looking for, what do I want? What would be the ideal woman in my life, you know? And when I see her, I will know this is the woman I want to marry. Okay, so, you know, I started going to these people, fix you up, shatchanim, some people call them shatganim, but whatever. And I went to these matchmakers, matchmaker, make me a match. And, you know, I used to be very, you know, just very general. You know, I want a girl, a nice girl. You know, this time I said, I'm not wasting my time. I'm going to tell this person exactly what I'm looking for. So I took this list. And they said, well, what exactly are you looking for? I'm glad you asked that question. Here it is. Okay? And I went for it. I went for it. And every point I came up with, this guy's jaw started to drop. I mean, it was like, you know, he said, I don't know anybody who's got that. I mean, I don't even know if they exist in this world. You know, maybe in Plato's world, but in this world, I don't know where they, you know, I don't know anybody like that. I said, well, I don't want to waste my time. And when you find such a person, get in touch, right? But until you find that, I just don't want to waste my time. Well, anyways, believe it or not, about 2 weeks later, I got a call from this fellow. He says, I don't believe it. I think I have someone who has everything you have on your list. I said, really? I got very nervous, you know? You get nervous now, like, uh-oh, that was real. Okay, fine. So I said, okay, I'm strong. I'm brave. Why not? Go ahead. So I, you know, go to this date. All right, fine. Now, and I, in a very clever, manipulative way, figure out how I'm going to find out if she's got everything on my list. Right? So, you know, I start off this conversation, and in the back of my mind, I've got my entire list, right? And I'm going very carefully down the list as I figure out how to find out who this person is. Well, okay, you know, okay, she's got number one, number two, number three, number four. And as the evening went on, I would say that she had at least 95% of everything I had on my list. And I couldn't stand her, right? She drove me crazy. And I wasn't interested. Right? And that's when I realized what's on paper and what's in reality are completely different. Right? And the only way you will know is when you will know, when you encounter. Right? And you cannot have these preconceived notions and conditions what religion must fulfill for you, what truth must fulfill for you. That's not the way one truthfully encounters life. I remember I was teaching a class, it was a philosophical class, in the middle of the class, a fellow puts up his hand and he says, "Excuse me, Rabbi, can you ride your bike on Shabbat?" I said, "I beg your pardon?" He said, "Can you just answer the question, can you ride your bike on Shabbat?" I said, "Well, I mean, there's various halakhic opinions, but basically, no. That's all I need to know. Thank you very much." He walked out. It had nothing to do with bicycles, right? If you have your preconceived notions, your conditions on what truth will be for you, then you'll never get there. Just as if you have your preconceived notions on who your soulmate must be and the conditions that they will fill, you'll never meet them, right? You've got to be open. And when you meet them, you get involved, you spend some time, only then and only then can you honestly say, you know. Right? You know. And you can know at that point. And sometimes you can know in a way that you might not be able to articulate in words. Right? But the fact that you cannot articulate in words in no way minimizes or should not minimize what you know. Because right? What you know is what you know. Right? You've encountered it. Right? Personally, my belief in Torah is not based on sitting around too long and justifying and proving and this and that. Because right? All that proving wouldn't get me any closer to God. It would only help me feel more comfortable to do what I have to do anyways, which is open the door and enter through the Word and act and experiment and see, right? What I could know at that moment. Right? And only then, as it says in the Bible, it says in the Talmud, that a voice of God is emerging from Sinai daily. Right? And what is this voice of God? The Maharal says it's not an outer voice, it's an inner voice that you can hear. You can hear that voice daily. Right? It's an inner realization that one can have as to that understanding that I am Jewish, and that's a reality, not simply a description. Right? And there is a very real vision to being Jewish. There's a very real difference in terms of how I encounter God and how anybody else will encounter God. And that doesn't mean better or worse. Just different. Right? Just different. And so, back to Kierkegaard. Any poet's existence is a sin, vis-a-vis the sin that one is writing poetry instead of living, that one occupies oneself with God and truth only in one's imagination instead of aiming at experiencing both experientially. This is from an either or. Right? That's what people have to be willing to do. Get beyond the thinking. Not to exclude the thinking. Right? Because if what you're doing is completely irrational, then you should really think about it carefully. Think about it carefully. Because they should be able to still be integrated. But remember, life goes beyond the mind. Right? And if you want to get to life, you're going to have to reach beyond your head. And that's where you grab it. You hold on to it. Right? And encounter it and touch it and embrace it. So this is Al Netilat Yadayim. This is what the Jewish people lived with. Right? Actions. And when people say, oh, they just talk about the law, the law, the law, the law, what else is there to talk about? Everything else is just cheap talk. The question is, what do you do? Right? I could meet a person who says they're religious, and they dress in a way that people say, oh, look, they're religious. But they treat people like dirt. If they treat people like dirt, they don't know God. Right? They don't even believe in God. They say they believe in God, but they couldn't believe in God. Because if they did, they wouldn't treat people like dirt. Right? It's the action. It is Jewish law that is actually the philosophy of the Jewish people. It is there where the great sages spent their time to understand the law, not only to understand it, in order to know what to do. That's the only purpose of learning for Judaism. It's in order, ultimately, to know what to do. Ein ha midrash ha'ikar ela ha-ma'aseh, says in the Talmud. It's not the mental gymnastics which is the essence, it's the action. And therefore, from Moda Ani Lefanecha, which is the goal, we wake up in the morning and say, so what's our goal? What's the definition of our lives? Right? Thanking and acknowledging, I am before you because you gave me back my soul. Now, what's the first step towards that goal? And what is the most direct manifestation of that goal? for the Jewish people, it's al netilat yadayim, raising up my hands in the service of God, taking my hands as I express myself and assert myself in a relationship with God, fulfilling the responsibilities derivative of such a relationship.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.